This is the Financial Side of Life podcast, episode 16.
Welcome to the Financial Side of Life podcast. Our mission, to empower you with smart financial strategies and show that it's possible to get a college education, save, invest, retire, or do whatever makes sense to help you live your best life. We'll meet amazing people and professionals who will share stories about how they do it, and together we hope to bring a little sanity to your complex financial life. And now, here is your host, certified financial planner pro and founder of Avea Financial Planning, Angie Ferbaten-LaRossi.
Hey everybody, Angie Ferbaten-LaRossi here. I'm joined today by Nathan Burt of Burt Tax from right here in the Tri-Cities. And his website is burttax.com, B-U-R-T-tax.com. And we're going to talk a little bit today on a few variety of topics that are related to both college planning and just taxes in general for 2018. His dad is Ron Burt, and he started his own business, this business, about 35 years ago. And Nathan has come into the business as an owner in the last few years as well. So I want to welcome Nathan to our program. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I listen to a lot of podcasts religiously, so it's fun to be a part of one.
Awesome. Me too. I listen to quite a few as well. So I kind of like to start by having you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your business. Anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, so I never thought I'd come back to the Tri-Cities to do what my dad does, but I graduated in the middle of the recession. And so I had a degree in accounting and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I decided to take a little break and I taught seventh grade language arts for 2 years.
You did? Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I still put some entrepreneurial skills to work in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to feel like an entrepreneur in the classroom. And that was kind of fun for me. And I've always kind of enjoyed that aspect of my profession, is that a lot of people are self-employed, and that's kind of what drew me to it. Mm-hmm. I worked for a couple of companies in the past. After Teach for America, I went back and got a master's degree in accounting, and I worked for Clearwater Analytics. And at that company, we supported companies in their accounting treatment for insurance portfolios. And so I worked in a little cubicle, and it was kind of fun because of the people there. And then I worked for another accounting company called Clifton Larson Allen in their Boise office, and worked again in cubicles, and it was okay. But I realized that cubicle life was not something where I wanted to spend the rest of my life. and so not long after that, I decided it might be more appealing than it used to be to come back to live in the Tri-Cities. My dad was looking for an exit strategy from his business. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of worked out in terms of timing and everything else. And I've loved it. I never thought in college I would say I love working in a small business in a small town, but I do.
Excellent. Well, that's kind of the nature of life. It just changes as we mature and things happen. So part of our topic today, we are into this year, 2018, 11 months now, wondering what kind of things there should be, key things for listeners to be either paying attention to or knowing about with regard to their 2018 taxes before year end. If there's anything that, with the new recent tax changes that occurred, people should be paying special attention to.
Yeah, it's gonna be a wild year for us. The e-filing system for us is about to turn off, and we'll turn back on again when the IRS begins accepting 2018 returns. And I suspect that they might not get that going again until maybe February sometime. They've been late in the past where we'll start taking appointments at the end of January. Or middle of January, but we can't file returns till the very end of January.
Okay.
I just can't see how they're going to get things going until early to mid-February. And so that I think it'll delay tax filing. It'll delay government collections for a while. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
And that's because of the recent changes, the whole tax law change?
Yeah. So the proposed 1040 looks differently. So there's a half page in the front, half page in the back, with a series of new schedules.
Okay.
And so that all has to get integrated with everybody's software packages and e-filing system. So there's a lot of work to do on that side for the IRS and for companies like Intuit and CCH and Thomson Reuters.
Mm-hmm. All the tax companies.
But it's also wild for the tax preparers because we essentially have two sets of tax codes floating around in our minds. We have all these numbers from 2017, and prior to that, it was similar numbers from about 1986 to 2017. The last major tax overhaul was in 86, and so there's so many changes in the new tax law that it's going to take a year or two to really familiarize ourselves with it, I think. I've taken a lot of continuing education hours here in the last year, and I feel comfortable with it, but there's still some loose ends in my mind.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure. So any key takeaways for listeners to have in mind as this year wraps up, as they, you know, look to closing out this tax year?
Yeah, a lot of the key things, a lot of the urgent action items were really due at the end of December of 2017. That's when the standard deduction was at its last year of being in the $12,000 range. And so if you were expecting itemized deductions of $20,000 or so, maybe you sped a lot of those up into 2017. There are some action items for the end of 2018. One of the big changes is a new 20% business income deduction. And so that's where you want to make sure that you're, especially for the self-employed folks, your sources of income are balanced the way you like between wages versus business income from your pass-through, such as a S-corporation or partnership. On the individual side, there are some things you might want to consider. For example, with the new standard deduction, some people will end up in the $20,000 range for itemized deductions. So they've been itemizing for years and years, and they may not itemize for 2018. Some of those people are choosing to bunch deductions. So If there's a year when you're expecting charitable deductions, maybe you bunch that with a large purchase like a vehicle. So you bunch your charitable deductions and your sales tax deductions in 1 year, or you group your charitable deductions from many years into 1 year.
Okay. So those are good strategies to think about going forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
With their current tax structure. Okay, bunching. Okay, so the next section. So Nathan, one of the areas that I focus on in my planning practice is college funding, paying for college. And there are families who really won't qualify for much financial aid, depending on their income and their assets. And so for them, I'm wondering if there are any, we like to call them tax scholarships, because basically every dollar saved is a dollar that you could spend toward college. So tax scholarships, anything that listeners could be thinking of in terms of tax scholarships for themselves, for their family?
Yeah, absolutely. One of these strategies that we'll be thinking about today is income shifting. Two common tax strategies have to do with brackets. So if you're trying to, especially in retirement, you're trying to maximize lower brackets. Income shifting refers to multiple people. So if one person's in a high bracket, you try to shift income, if it's going to be mutually beneficial, to someone in a lower bracket. And there's some advantages besides income taxes for those people in lower brackets. So let's say you have a self-employed mother and father who are not anticipating financial aid. They might want to shift some of their income to their child who's in a lower tax bracket. If they are anticipating financial aid, it could be disadvantageous to do so because the FAFSA or institutions look at earnings and income from kids differently from parents. So if we're just considering those folks who are not anticipating financial aid, then it just makes a ton of sense for them to get income into their dependents' names and not into their name any longer.
Right. So they're saving on taxes.
Yeah. So let's say the parents' income the tax bracket is in the 30% range and the child tax bracket is in the 10% range. Keep in mind there are some negative side effects like payroll taxes, which will be about 7% for the employer. So you have to factor that in to the kids' income as well. But there are some non-income tax items as well, or not just straight ordinary income tax, things like capital gain taxes that you can be thinking about as well. Mm-hmm. So let's say that a self-employed set of parents employs one of their kids and pays them $20,000 a year. So it lowers their taxable income by $20,000, but that was going to be taxed at, let's say, 37%. And now you're going to be taxing that $20,000 at 10% after the standard deduction. So they might be paying $1,000 or $2,000 of that on that for taxes instead of somewhere closer to $8,000.
Okay. Again, just every dollar saved on taxes is money in your pocket to spend toward college.
Yeah, so some people choose to amplify that income shifting strategy by gifting kids not cash but appreciated stock. Mm-hmm. So then the kid sells the stock for cash, but their capital gain rate's 0%, whereas the parents would have been 20%.
Mm-hmm. So again, another tax savings.
Yeah, so let's say that the father and the mother both chose to gift the child the federal gift tax limit of $15,000. So they gift them $30,000 of whatever stock, let's say Amazon stock, with a really low basis. So let's say in total their capital gain is $20,000. The parents would have paid at least $4,000 on that, and the child pays zero. So if you employ both of those strategies, the income shifting and the gifting, you could save $10,000+.
Okay, so these are pretty much applied to families that have businesses, or would you also say for contractors?
Yeah, a lot of independent contractors are taxed as S corporations. And so if that's the case, you can still employ your kids. You will have to take out Social Security and Medicare and issue them a W-2. Some independent contractors are taxed as sole proprietorships. And if that's the case, then the wages given to kids are treated a little bit differently. You still have to issue them a W-2, but you don't have to withhold FICA taxes. And so they have to be performing something that's of actual service to your business, or you'd have to pay somebody else otherwise. But most people can think of something.
Well, and I recently, I also sat in on a tax-focused webinar. And even for the example that this guy gave was that, you know, you could have a small child, even as young as 2 or 3, be a model for your brochure or for your television commercial, you know, and they're fulfilling a role that is warranted to be paid. So you're right. You can find something that they can do.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities to be creative.
For sure. Okay. Anything else come to mind as far as shifting income, shifting strategies that apply to small businesses, families with businesses?
Yeah, so if you decide that it's advantageous for your child to file their own tax return and claim themselves as a dependent, they might also be more eligible for the American Opportunity Tax Credit versus the parents. So the parents' income may have been too high, so they were out of the range for the American Opportunity Credit, which is significant. So that's $2,500 a year if eligible for the full thing. So if you can get that to the kids, then that would be ideal.
Right. And so say the family phased out, so they were only able to, or the parents were only able to qualify for $2,000, and then if the student could take the full $2,500, that's an extra $2,000 in their pocket over the course of 4 years, because every savings is potentially times four for 4 years.
Right. Yeah. So keep in mind that the credit goes with the dependent. So if they file their own tax return, but you claim them as a dependent, then the credit sticks with you. But if they qualify to be their own dependent and claim themselves, then the credit goes with them. So there's also some other tricks that I've learned with the American Opportunity Tax Credit, and that has to do with scholarships and grants. So you have to look at the 1098-T that the institution gives you. So every accredited institution should give the student a 1098-T. Once in a while, it seems like the institution won't if their tuition was really low or their scholarships and grants were just way higher than their tuition. But in most cases, that form is available from the school. What I've seen occasionally is, let's say on the 1098-T, the amounts billed for tuition or amounts received for tuition on line one or two is around $10,000. And then I think it's in box five, you have amounts paid for by scholarships and grants. Let's say that's $10,000, but you find out from the student that $5,000 was a scholarship from the school and $5,000 was a grant from somewhere else. Or it could be from the school, or it could be from the government. In some instances, you can count that grant as taxable income and remove it out of that box. And that might seem counterintuitive because usually you're trying to get money away from counting as income. But in this case, if the scholarships and grants were equal to the tuition, you wouldn't qualify for any American Opportunity Tax Credit at all if you didn't have any additional expenses. So if you could take $5,000 out of that box and put it as taxable income, the student's probably in the 10% bracket, so they'd pay $500 on that $5,000 of income, but then they'd have $5,000 of eligible education expenses to be used up for the American Opportunity Tax Credit. And so you have $2,000 on the first, you have 100% of the first $2,000 that you can take as a credit, plus 25% of the next $2,000. So you could take whole credit in that situation.
Again, and so even those, you know, few hundred dollar differences add up, especially times four, if you're doing this for 4 years of college. Excellent. Okay. Anything else to add kind of on those two areas, Nathan? Because I wanted to go into another direction.
I think looking back, when I was going to school, I was kind of fortunate, one, to go to kind of a cheaper school. So my school is similar to a state school. Actually, I guess I went to two states, or one state school and one private school, but the private school is BYU, and so it's church-sponsored. Mm-hmm. So it was like $2,500 or $3,000 a semester or somewhere in that range, which is maybe comparable or a little bit less in WSU or UW. For tuition, is that right?
Tuition's right around $10,000, just over $10,000
for the semester.
For the year.
So for the year at BYU, it's still I guess cheaper. Okay. And then for graduate school, I went to BSU. But in both instances, I was really fortunate. I got a scholarship at both places, and then at some point in my schooling, I got married, and so we started qualifying for Pell Grants. So once you got married, you didn't have to count your parents' income on the FAFSA. So we ended up coming out of school making a little bit of money by going to school, which I think is an unusual situation. But I don't think it's impossible for kids to do that today through work and grants. But it's getting more and more difficult as
it sure
as
seems
tuitions
to be
rise.
Right. Mm-hmm. And thus the planning that's emphasized to go into that, figuring out how they're going to pay for full 4 years of college.
Yeah, I have sticker shock when I hear about kids going to undergrad for $50,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'll let my kid do that.
Yeah.
I think I might say, here's the list of great public schools that you can choose from. Or hopefully you get some scholarships if you want to go to a private school. But I think the real value add for schooling that higher level is graduate school. And I think that's where it's worth paying the extra money for.
Mm-hmm. Something, too, I wanted to add on the American Opportunity Tax Credit is that, like you said, you need to have qualifying expenses, or you need to put money towards college expenses, money that's not from a 529 plan, for example. And I like to describe it as money that you pay from your pocket, basically something from your savings or cash flow. And then in order to get that full $2,500 credit, And so a lot of times you might have the thought to pay for a full year's worth of college expenses from a 529 plan, when really you should be spreading out those 529 plan expenditures over the full 4 years of college or more, you know, at least the full 4 years, because you want to make sure you maintain that eligibility for the American Opportunity Tax Credit.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Let's say that you forget and you use too much the first year. You might think about buying the student some things that they'll probably need for the rest of their attendance at that school. A laptop is often required for schooling these days, and so have your kid keep track of their receipts for the office equipment, like computers and speakers and printers and ink and all tablets maybe and stuff like that that may be required as the cost of attendance and included in eligible expenses for that credit.
Okay. So I touched on 529 plans. One of the things, I wish I had the statistic, I can find it and put it in our show notes, but there's not a majority of people saving money for college in 529 plans, apparently. Most people are still saving for 529 plans in their bank account or just investment brokerage type accounts, not getting the tax preferential treatment on that money. And so 529 plans, I think, sometimes need a little bit of explanation, you know, why we should consider using them, what are the tax benefits of using them versus perhaps other ways of saving, or in addition to 529 plans, what are other ways that we might consider saving for college? Would you maybe just start by touching on what are some of the benefits of saving into a 529 plan for a college-bound kid?
Sure. Yeah, I'm probably biased against 529 plans because I'm in Washington,
okay,
where there's no state income tax deduction for it, mm-hmm, and because as a tax professional, it's a pain to put 529 plan distributions onto people's tax returns because they have to integrate into all these different forms.
So
you've got to make sure that you've got the recipient right, whoever the account's name is under, and that it's going into the education-related forms, and if there's any excess earnings into the taxable parts of the forms. And so it takes a little while to get the 529 distributions into somebody's tax return properly.
Okay. That's so, good insider information.
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't help you with that. But
but I'm also against it because there's so many stipulations, there's so many strings attached to 529 plans, whereas let's say you use a Roth IRA instead.
Mm-hmm.
That's my preferred method for using earnings to pay for or accounts set aside for education.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no stipulations. Let's say that you have excess Roth IRA funds. Well, then it goes to your retirement. But if you have excess 529 plans, all of a sudden you have penalties that you have to start thinking about. And so,
well, but you have other options too. You know, you can hang on to the account and use it for another child. You can hang on to the account and use it for yourself. You could, you know, leave it as sort of an estate planning tool and use it for your next generation, your kids' kids. So, you know, you don't actually have to pull it out. It seems like you might want to, but there are some other alternatives.
Yeah, that's true. I do like the simplicity of Roth IRAs over 529 plans. However, if you're in a state with state income tax, there's an apparent benefit or advantage, mm-hmm, of 529 plans over Roth IRAs.
Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about saving into Roth IRA, are you saying that it's the parents' Roth IRA,
yeah,
or the student,
mm-hmm,
or,
yeah,
both?
So the parents, so usually if you take money out of a retirement account, you're going to be taxed on that distribution plus a penalty if you're under 59 and a half. But with the Roth IRA, there's an exception. There's an exception for a traditional IRA for that too. But if you're under 59 and a half and you're withdrawing a Roth IRA for education purposes, for higher education, then there's no penalty on that distribution.
On the gain.
There's no penalty on any of the distribution. And then there's no tax either except for
the gain. Penalty. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the drawback to that, though, is that when you pull money out of a Roth IRA, it's now counted as untaxed income on the FAFSA. So again, it depends on the family situation. If they are not expecting to get any financial aid or limited financial aid, then they may not be so concerned about that. But it is a consequence of that action, is that now it's adversely affects the FAFSA.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. The FAFSA is like, it's almost like it's a new set of tax code.
Yeah,
it seems like
it is. Yeah, new rules and strategies associated with trying to maximize your ability, you know, to receive financial aid. And that's why we kind of explore all these different options, is trying to, you know, illuminate some of the ideas behind what you may be able to do to make your situation a little bit better on the FAFSA.
Yeah, so a lot of my time is spent working with small businesses. So I deal a lot with owners of S corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a small business owner, your adjusted gross income is so malleable. You can really have a lot of flexibility. And so we'll try to meet with all of our S corp owners at the end of the year, because we don't want them to be surprised by tax bills the following spring. And because we don't like it when clients are surprised, because they don't tend to be real happy with us with surprises, we won't charge to meet and do that year-end tax planning.
Excellent. Okay. Are there any specifics that you are looking at this time of year?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a balancing act with most choices dealing with taxes. And the balancing act right now, I think, is deciding whether you want to take advantage of these historic low tax rates now, or do you have other reasons to lower your taxable income? So if you have the option to pre-purchase some of your supplies or a company vehicle or something like that to lower your income, it might be a good idea to do that if there's other factors like you're coming up on a base year for the FAFSA application for a kid.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you might consider holding off when tax rates go back up again if you're considering buying some equipment and vehicles. I'm just not convinced these tax rates are going to stay low permanently.
And when do they expire? Or is it 25?
Yeah, a lot of the provisions expire in 2025, but you just never know with shifting political parties in the White House.
There's absolutely no way to predict the future. And with a lot of these things that we look at with regard to tax strategies, they are hedges against trying to gauge now versus later, especially with the retirement piece, because retirement for many people can be decades away. And to predict what the tax situation will be in a couple decades is impossible. So yeah, you just do the best you can, really.
Yeah. Mm. It seems like, though, if you were coming up on a base year for your FAFSA application, it would be advantageous to get your adjusted gross income as low as you can.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let me clarify, too, what base year is. Base year we describe now, because it changed in the last year and a half. It's the prior year to the year that the student is starting school. So, for example, if a student is starting school in 2019, the fall of 2019, their tax base year would be 2017 tax year. And so that's where planning comes in, because some of these things that we think about when we talk about planning for that base year have to kind of come into play even a year or two prior to that. So it does take a little bit of forethought to look ahead for planning for your college-bound student.
Yeah, ultimately it's situational, but let's say you have a couple with self-employment income from an S corporation of $150,000, and you're coming up to that point where you want to get income really low. If you bought a work vehicle or equipment for your business that's going to be an investment in the future,
mm-hmm.
Let's say you cut your income in half, it just seems like that's going to pay some dividends on the current tax situation and then also on the financial aid. I mean, even if you have the opportunity to cut your adjusted gross income, you still need to do analysis of what you're buying and make sure it's going to give you returns in the future besides tax savings. I think some people get a little carried away, and because they're saving so much on taxes, don't really fully evaluate the payoff that they're going to receive from that new asset, and where they would have been better off just not buying anything in the first place. So,
right.
I mean, there's always opportunities to invest in your own business, but you still want to analyze everything that you're investing in and make sure you're going to get a return on it.
Well, and as a comprehensive financial planner, just making decisions solely based on the tax impact is not usually the only reason to make a decision. We want to look at the full picture before making a final decision.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising how many people forget about the whole picture when they just have a chip on their shoulder for the government and wanting
yeah,
to lower their taxes.
It gets personal at that point, doesn't it? Okay, very good. Well, Nathan, as we wrap up our conversation, I always like to ask our guests, what might be your key piece of advice to our listeners? And I would say maybe along the lines of tax planning in general or tax planning for 2018.
Yeah, sure. So I always like to know where I'm at. So, I mean, it's probably just the accountant coming out in me, but I check my tax liability for the year probably on a monthly or semi-monthly basis. There's no reason where you shouldn't know where you're going to come out on taxes by November. And so I think you ought to know where you're at, not just for tax purposes, but if you don't have a clear profit and loss for your business, and how are you really measuring your performance and success?
Okay, so keeping track of personal expenses, keeping track of business profit and loss, knowing where you're at.
Yeah, I think the other piece of advice I think that I've been trying to personally strive for is just to keep costs down. I heard something the other day that I thought was really funny. When someone is saying that they wanted to be a millionaire, someone else is like, I think what you mean is that you want to spend $1 million, because if you were a millionaire, that means you didn't spend $1 million. And so something that I keep in mind personally is that if I don't spend $1 million, that's how you get to be a millionaire.
Excellent. Okay. As we come into the holiday season, good advice. All right. Well, thank you, Nathan. I want to thank you for stopping by the podcast booth and sharing, you know, some of your wisdom and your experience in your work with regard to taxes and tax planning. And thank you for listening as well. Be sure to check over the show notes for more details from our conversation. I invite you to listen again and subscribe to our podcast at aveafp.com. That's AVEAF like financial, P like planning.com. And leave a review. And please join our exclusive podcast community on Facebook at Financial Side of Life. Thank you for tuning in.